Has federalism hurt Nigeria? Today on The Curious Task, I speak with Oyebade Oyerende. Welcome to The Curious Task from the Institute for Liberal Studies, where we explore economics, politics, philosophy, and other ideas from a classical liberal perspective. I'm Alex Aragona, your host, and today I'm speaking with Oyebade Oyerende. Oyebade is an associate professor and data scientist at Clark Atlanta University, and his interests include, among many other things, polycentric order and federalism in Africa. Oyebade, welcome to The Curious Task.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
And it's great to have you on. So, Oyebade, we base each episode on a question or a theme, and then we go over the answers and conversation takes us. Our question and theme today is, has federalism hurt Nigeria? And I think it's fair to say that many of our listeners are not at all familiar with how we can link classical liberal themes to Nigeria or any other African country for that matter. And myself, I'm not that familiar either. So I'm very excited to be talking about this and having it as a very educational episode. So having said that, I do want to start with as much context as possible, especially for those who are unfamiliar with certain things politically, economically, and otherwise in Nigeria. So right off the bat, can you describe Nigeria's current structure of government and sort of just describe the political scene on the country there? And then we'll ask other detailed questions. But I just first want to illustrate a picture in our listeners' mind of the kind of environment they're talking about as of today.
Oh, thank you for that, excellent question. Today, Nigeria operates as a federal political, system. And what that means is that there is a national government at the center. Then there are subnational governments that fall into two categories. We have state government, and we also have local government. And the country as a whole has one constitution. And normally, one would think that all the constituent governmental units are autonomous in their respective domain of influence. But in reality, much of the power is concentrated in the national government that serves as the final authority. But I can assure you that when you talk to lawyers, especially in Nigeria, they may dispute what I've just said simply because they will go straight to the constitution by looking at the different powers that are given to, for example, state government, and those powers that are given to the national government. But within the same constitution, there is a provision that actually, put the most important power in the national, government. And just before we go to some context here, for people to understand that the national government operates as the final authority. For example, the entire country has one single police force, and that police force is under the control of the national government. That's one. Number two, the state government in Nigeria, along with the local government, depends largely on the national government for revenue. And when you look at what I've just talked about, we begin to see how the national government exercises enormous power within the federal system that Nigeria currently operates.
Yes. So would you say then in summary, and of course I know it's unfair to just summarize things, there's so much nuance here, but it's, as you said, if you talk to some lawyers or even some politicians there, they'll point to a constitution of a federation with delegated powers and so on and so forth. So is it fair to say in theory, there should be this federal setup where powers are indeed delegated and there is a balance, but in practice, what really happens is more of a centralization of power among certain groups and certain elites and certain positions in the structure?
Oh, thank you for that question. The question could be approached in a variety of ways, but this is how I'm going to respond to it in the context of the publication that I have had, and based on the training that I've had, and in addition, based on my own personal experience especially of the political system. Now, in principle, we should ask the question, the Constitution itself, where did it come from? Mm-hmm. The Constitution was based on the expertise of very few people. And those individuals, they really do not represent the interests, the creativity, the values of the masses. And of course, when we're talking about Nigeria, we're talking about so many communities, and people, they have a diverse value, diverse interests. But when the Constitution was being put in place, the values and interests of ordinary people were not taken into consideration. And that is to begin to, for example, see how, for example, what they have as the Constitution that some people may approach as a form of principle is not even reflective of the values and interests of the people. Now, looking at it that way, for me, it is not surprising that in practice, the country have a centralized form of government, simply because in principle as well, in terms of how the Constitution came into existence, everything is more or less centralized, without regard, especially for the interests of ordinary individual.
Mm-hmm. And you said in a note to us, actually, I think it was an email to a producer when we were preparing the episode, that one thing that the way you're going to approach the question today is to make us understand that, federalism in Nigeria is the way it's practiced is a structure rather than, and I quote you here, a process of self-rule and shared rule relationships. Can you get into a bit more detail about what you would mean about the fact that in what we're seeing is not self-rule and shared relationships among, different people, sectors, and so on and so forth?
Okay. Thank you for that, question. Going back to what I've written about, the country, normally when we are talking about federalism, as just reflected in your question, we're talking about self-governance relationships, which really serve as the key to social justice and also the key to the promotion of individual liberty, public peace, and then political and economic integration. But as far as Nigeria is concerned, federalism is nothing more but structure. And what does that mean? As in the context of Nigeria, federalism must be equated with having national government, state government, and local government, without the processes of self-governance relationship. Typically speaking, federalism focuses on how people, not elite in government, how people, right, not experts, how people governed, especially with one another, and then serve as a check on one another and prevent circumstances in which some individuals, some expert, exploit other individual. And what I've just talked about as the key ingredient of federalism just lacking, especially in Nigeria. And we could see, for example, why this has been the case. For example, in looking at why this has been the case, it's important to look at how federalism in Nigeria, in terms of the current system being operated, came into existence. The political system was consciously designed in 1954. And that design was undertaken by some Western-educated Nigerians, along with the departing colonialists. And basically, up to 1954, there have been tensions among three major ethnic groups, the Yoruba ethnic group, which happened to be my own ethnic group, and Igbo and the Hausa Fulani. Now, the crisis among those ethnic groups was not declared as the reason for designing that particular political system then. But actually, that was the purpose, because at the end of the day, it became quite obvious that the federal system was put in place to pacify those three major ethnic groups, who really, in turn, the subnational government that were created to repress other minority communities in the country. And if you look at what I've just talked about, it's very, very obvious that the interests of diverse individuals within the geographical expression called Nigeria today were not even taken into consideration in 1954 when the departing colonialists and Western educated people who serve as elites then were putting this arrangement in place. And when we look at it that way, it's not quite difficult to begin to see why what was put in place as a structure is a system of centralized government, as opposed to a system in which people govern with themselves in their various communities, in their various villages, in different settings that people have evolved based on their creativities, values, and interests.
Mm-hmm. And to continue that train of thought, then we look at Nigeria today. You have also noted that, federalism in Nigeria has meant two things. And you say, one, centralization of power by a ruling class. And we've talked a bit about that. And then two, repression of liberty for individuals. But for number one first, just to get a little further into that, because again, I think I find this very fascinating and interesting, and I think our listeners are largely unfamiliar with this stuff. That's why I want as much details as possible. Back to that centralization of power by the ruling class today, you talked a bit about the historical context of that. When you mean a centralization of power by the ruling class today, if one were to look at Nigeria from that classical liberal or traditional liberal perspective and see where the power dynamics are and what the ruling class is today, how would you describe that? Is it still elites that fancy themselves Western educated and more enlightened than others? Is it back to the ethnic conflict history? Could you explain a little bit more about what you mean by centralization of power and the ruling class today?
Okay. What happened with that is that when you are talking about, if we are talking about the locus of power today, actually reside with those who run the governmental structures that actually been described as a system of federalism in the country. For example, maybe we throw more light on it. For example, ordinary individuals, they really have not exercised the power to evolve their own governing units within which they can provide their public goods and services. For example, basic services like water supplies, streets, and even schools, all those are being controlled by the national government, even though those services were to be provided by, state government, being controlled by the national government, because as I said earlier on, state government and local government, they depend for revenue on the national government. And the national government uses revenue as an instrument of control to decide what can be done in local government and in state government. So the people in different parts of the country, they cannot do anything other than to wait for what the national government will carry out through the subnational government. For example, as I said the other time, to really understand the centralization of power in Nigeria, one could just look at the way the country is providing policing services. I live in the United States. And what is quite clear here is that policing services are not uniform, meaning that different places need different policing services. But as far as Nigeria is concerned, there is one single police force, and the chief police officer in Nigeria is the president of the country. And even though some people will say there is an inspector general of police, but that inspector general of police serve at the mercy of the president of Nigeria. And the president of Nigeria, who actually is the head of the executive branch, uses, not all the time, sometimes uses the police force to repress opposing forces. And when I talk about opposing forces, I also mean even politicians in the state and local government that do not get along, especially with the president. For example, in the past, some state governors, that is chief executive at the state level, they were removed from office through the way the national government used the police to threaten even state legislators. At least, seven state chief executives have been removed that way. Whenever, for example, the Supreme Court, the highest court in Nigeria, passed certain rules that the executive branch at the national level disagree with, the executive branch at the national level sometimes disregard even those rulings. For example, before the past administration left last year, there was a ruling from the Supreme Court that the efforts to change the currency note in Nigeria should be suspended. Even though the court made that decision, the executive branch at the national level decided not to even follow that particular ruling. Mm. And at the same time, when we look at the interaction between the national government and the state government, that kind of interaction is based on what I describe as a system of subordinate kind of relationship, where chief executive at the state level, defer to the national government when it comes to, for example, things that could be done within the state. Because at the state level, they don't have power over the police. And the national government may choose to use the single police force that the country acts, to clamp down on those at the state level.
Mm-hmm. And continuing on that train of thought about the centralization of power and how that works, so far we've talked a lot about the political dimension, a bit more on the economic dimension now. Do the same concepts, trains of thoughts, and types of things you described about the centralization of power, do you feel also applies to economic power in Nigeria? For example, is the government working with international corporations and so on and so forth? And there's a lot of sort of top-down decision-making when it comes to people's economic lives as well. Again, just as a context-setting question for our listeners.
Okay. Thank you for that. And this is how we approach the question. I will look at this in terms of employment in the country. For example, we may ask, who is the largest employer of labor in Nigeria? It is government. It is the government of Nigeria, whether we're talking about national government, state government, and local government. So, and what that means is that most people, they look up especially to the national government in particular, to provide their employment opportunity. And then before we even talk about, whether domestic or international cooperation, it's also important to look at who really control the private sector in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Those who operated, the private sectors, they are more or less under the control, especially of the national government, whether we are talking mm-hmm. about the banking sector, the manufacturing sector, and the agricultural sector. So all these economic activities, they are being directed, by the national, government. As I said the other time, the state, local, and national government in Nigeria, they happen to be the largest employers of labor. Now, when it comes to interaction between the government in Nigeria and international cooperation, that of course is being undertaken by the national government. I may give you some ideas about that based on my experience here in the United States. What we know here is that When an international organization, you know, corporation, they want to be in any part of this country, they negotiate even with, you know, state government, you know, negotiate with possibly local government. But as far as Nigeria is concerned, that market that in, that has many players does not really exist. All negotiation usually funnel through the national, you know, government. So economically, the national government in control because, again, as I said the other time, the key sector of the economy more or less under the control of the government and particularly the central government.
Mm-hmm. No, excellent. Thank you for that. These answers in this context has been immensely helpful so far, and I think great. And I, as I said before, the train of thought we were on, you know, you talked about federalism in Nigeria meaning two things, centralization of power, and on the other hand, repression of liberty for individuals. I've sort of focused so far on that centralization of power question, but I do now want to move us to that repression of liberty for of individuals. I think you've already talked about it as you've been answering other questions, but now I want to get to it a little more directly. When we think of all the contexts we just established, in your view, it sounds to me like you're saying that at the end of the day, the political and economic lives of so many in Nigeria is very limited as far as how they can participate in both the political and economic, as I said, sort of activity. That's what I'm hearing. But I'd like, again, you to educate us on that and provide more context on what your conclusion for individual liberty is in this situation.
Okay. Looking at that... and I guess this is how we approach that as well. When we talk about individual you know, liberty in Nigeria, we cannot isolate that, especially from how people themselves can engage in self-governance you know, relationship. The other time I talked about the structure of government in Nigeria involving the national government, the state government and the local you know, government. For example, in Nigeria today, people, they are not free, for example, to develop a governing unit of their own that are formally recognized. When I say formally recognized, unit that are constitutionally you know, recognized. As a matter of fact, the values and interests of people that could drive this, they are considered antithetical, especially to development, simply because they believe is that the system of government that is going to work at all must, you know, has to be rooted in Euro-American, you know, values. And those who control that system of government, they will now educate, you know, the masses on how to run that kind of you know, system. So what I'm saying here is that people have been denied the right, especially to determine how they want to conduct public affairs based on their own interests, based on their own creativities, based on their own value in their various setting in Nigeria. Let me give you one example here. When Nigeria was preparing for another return to civil rule in 1999, it was decided by the military dictators in charge at the national government then that they needed a new constitution. And they created this false impression that they wanted the interests and values of the people to be reflected in that constitution. So when they were putting that, you know, together, they, you know, selected some experts to go to some places in Nigeria. Unfortunately, those experts went to 8 cities in Nigeria, whereas Nigeria cities today has over 500 cities and over, you know, 2,000 villages, if I can put it that way. And those experts, they went to 8 cities, and in each of those 8 cities, they only stay in certain part of the city to collect the data that they wanted, especially you know, for framing that constitution. At the end of the day, people did not have any freedom to shape, you know, the outcome of that particular you know, process. And that's one major thing that I can use to illustrate that. Another thing is this: we should ask ourselves, what is the basis of state citizenship in Nigeria? And When we know that, we now begin to see how individual liberty is being repressed. For example, in Nigeria today, the basis of state citizenship is decent. That is, it is based on where you were born. It is based on your own ethnic group. What I'm trying to say here, that it is based on descent as opposed to residence. So what this means is that people like me, I am a citizen in my own home localities and states. And what that means is that if I were to move outside my home state, I cannot stand for political office, meaning I cannot compete for political office in strange state and localities, simply because my ethnic group is not rooted there in that part of the country. That does not mean that today we don't have some few instances in which people who have moved out of their state are able to stand for political office, in the old state, locality and state. Very few. But largely speaking, people's right to compete for political office is being denied as long as they are not within their own, localities and state. And I'm talking in terms of the context of the centralized system that is being even run at this time. What I've just discussed in terms of the basis of state citizenship is even fueling, separatism and nationalism in the country, even up to this, point that people, they are suspicious of each other. They hold a strong allegiance to their various ethnic groups. And that is one way to see how people's rights are being repressed. Now, another thing is this. The so-called governance or democracy law, whatever, has been reduced to one single thing in Nigeria, and that is election. And election is a thin aspect of so-called democracy. And what that means is that, citizens, they usually do not even have the right to freely determine who they want to govern themselves. For example, the process of party primaries in Nigeria was based on who can pay the largest amount of money, meaning that political candidates that emerge from party primaries, these are individuals that are able to give out a large amount of money, or individuals that are able to be, that are favored by the most powerful people within different electoral districts in the country. So the people themselves, they really don't shape those processes. And when people even come out for come out to vote in general election, of course we have some people that genuinely come out on their own to vote, but most often people are financially motivated by will of giving them money, bribes and stuff just to come out, especially to, vote. And even when election results are declared, those election results most often are falsified. And because of that, there's suspicion in terms of whether or not Nigeria has been conducting a free and fair election. So whichever way we go, we see people's rights being repressed, and it goes back to how, for example, the system that the country is operating in terms of, federalism, how that system came into existence. The system did not come into existence to support, to promote, and to protect, people's individual liberty in the first instance. The system was put in place just to protect the interests of people who run the structure.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that makes a lot of sense. And that was an excellent answer. I do have to take a break right now, Oyabade. So we'll do that right now, and then we're going to jump back in. So everyone, you're listening to The Curious Task. I'm speaking with Oyabade Oyerende today. The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. Feel free to send questions, feedback, guest recommendations, or anything else that's on your mind to curioustask@liberalstudies.ca. As always, a huge thanks to our supporters on Patreon, including Randy T. Simmons, Travis Smith, and John Robson. Remember to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at The Curious Task, rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to The Curious Task, and check out the Institute for Liberal Studies. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to The Curious Task. I'm speaking with Oyabade Oyarende today. So, Oyabade, I think the first half was excellent. I think there was a lot of context there, a lot of education there about the Nigerian context when it comes to the political and economic situation. The main question I was asking there was, you were saying, you said in a note to us, you know, that there's centralization of power by ruling class in Nigeria, repression of liberty for individuals. I think you've described that very nicely, and I think there's a lot of context there. Now I want to switch gears to something you've been alluding to, you've been talking. If the system is not designed, as you said, to basically empower people in a way that they can self-direct, self-rule, and participate as much as they should be in their economic and political lives, my question to you is now going to be more based on your work and your essays that I've read over, which is, how do we relate everything you've been talking about here back to thinkers that you seem to appreciate, like Friedrich Hayek, Eleanor Ostrom? You've cited them frequently in your work on this topic, and I'm going to leave this very open-ended on purpose so you can take it the direction you wish. What specific insights do you think when it comes to self-government, self-rule, and polycentric systems do you bring to the table here when it comes to Nigeria? And how do you think, if anyone would allow us to fix the problem, what kind of insights do you think would improve the situation from your work on this topic?
Yeah, that's a great question again here. In fixing the governance crisis, not just in Nigeria alone, but also in different parts of Africa, it becomes inevitable to think quite critically regarding how, for example, diverse people in Nigeria and in other African countries can be given the freedom, or maybe allowed to exercise the freedom, to use their own interests, their values, their creativities, their ideas, in terms of how they see themselves. When I say the ideas, I'm trying to throw light on that, how they see themselves, how they, you know, see their relationship with others, how they conceive of their cosmological, you know, world in terms of the way they approach the universe. So using all those ingredients, especially to figure out ways in which they can put in place the kind of governing arrangements that could provide, goods and services that meet their various need in their different, setting. And this is where I will bring Hayek, in. Based on the work Hayek that I've been reading, I believe from, I would say from 2020 through a close friend of mine who actually exposed, that particular work, to me. It becomes quite obvious that going forward in Nigeria and in other African nations, the kind of orders, social orders that may fix the problem on the continent will be social orders that are not consciously designed. Instead, there will be social orders that emerge, especially as people interact, as people interact, freely in pursuing their various interests, as opposed to what we have today, where the structure that we have in Nigeria and in some other African nation, if not in many African nations, just based on the values and interests, for example, of those who are in charge of those, government. And when we talk about people putting in place social, orders, definitely the structures within which they will be engaging in self-governance relationships, they are not likely to be the same. So, and this is where I take issue with this idea of trying to mimic Europe and America. There's no doubt mm-hmm. that there are important lessons to learn from Europe and America, but you know, just engaging in kind of sweeping, you know, imitation, that is going to be, you know, counterproductive. So, and for example, from my training under Fisen Ockstrom, you know, Elina Ockstrom, I've learned a critical lesson that people, they are capable of governing themselves, and people, irrespective of their level of civilization, they do have what it takes, especially to, you know, figure out ways to engage in conducting public affairs, because when they do so, of course, there will be mistakes. And making mistake is not really a big deal, especially when we come when it comes to the conduct of public affairs, because as humans, we are capable of making mistakes, and at the same time, we are capable of learning from those you know, mistakes. And I think what I've just talked about hold true just in any part of the world. So the issue is, as far as Nigeria is concerned, we have to begin to focus on where said governing capability itself reside. And as I said earlier on, self-governing capability reside there in the, you know, the people themselves. And the people themselves, they should serve as the final authority in terms of how they want to, you know, pursue they want to put in place mechanism to confront their daily exigency. And I think without emphasizing the role that people play in the self-governing society, is extremely difficult even to begin to think about fixing the problems in Nigeria and in other African you know, nations.
Mm-hmm. And if Nigeria were to take small steps toward that on the political side, what do you think that might look like? Would that, you know, you described in the first half of our conversation, for example, the centralization of government powers. Would that look like, if we were to do this in a steady, you know, pace without jumping to utopia, which would be nice, but would it simply be, for instance, on the political side, for example, we look at a more serious form of delegation of powers and self-governance to different, maybe state levels and even further down
Okay, I don't want to even go to the concept of delegation of power at this point, but this is what I will say, simply because sometimes when we use all these concepts, they are victims of definitional pluralism, but as far as Nigeria is concerned, one small step that could be taken is to begin to treat, for example, different, you know, self-governing system that people themselves have, you know, evolved, you know, over time, to begin to recognize those self-governing, you know, system. And let me give you an example here. First, like market women associations, neighborhood associations, you know, transport, you know, unions, and all kind of, you know, labor unions in Nigeria. Those, you know, systems, they've been able to figure out, you know, self-governance structures, which really have been working for them. And just to focus on the neighborhood association, I will describe that a little bit, you know, for you here. In different parts of Nigeria, people are surviving today on the effort of neighborhood associations. And when I talk about neighborhood associations, I'm talking about associations that are formed by tenants and landlords. And those associations, they provide streets, they provide wells where people get water to drink, and they provide the kind of, I mean, security. And when we are talking about what, for example, Nigeria is surviving on today, neighborhood development associations happen to be one thing that they are using to survive in the country today. So this is what I'm saying here. Those, you know, structures in Nigeria, they need to begin to stop describing them as illegal, extra-legal, traditional, possibly primitive. They have to be recognized. And that was the reason why I say I will not really talk about delegation. because there is no power to delegate. All those structures already, they have the power. The issue is that they are not recognized. And this is what is intriguing about that. Now, politicians in Nigeria, especially at the local level, whenever they want to converse for vote, whenever they want to go to people to get support from people, they allegedly sometimes go to the leaders of neighborhood development association to hash them, to allow them to use the accomplishments that those associations have made, to allow them to use those accomplishments as if they were the one who have actually done all those things. So the question becomes, should those organization, association, should they continue to be dismissed as illegal, extra-legal, traditional, informal? That needs to be carefully reconsidered. And that is what I will consider to be like one small step that Nigeria as a nation may take. And I believe that if we go to other African nations as well, we are likely to see parallel structures that are being dismissed as extra-legal, illegal, traditional, and informal. So possibly that's what we may begin to do.
No, I think that was an excellent point you made about delegation, and we have to be very careful about that word and term, because the question to you and the answer as well seems to be, as you were saying, this isn't about the government figuring out a way to delegate powers or do things differently. The question for you seems to be, why don't we just recognize already existing arrangements and allow them to flourish? So you have the bottom-up perspective rather than the top-down perspective, if I understand you correctly.
You're correct. And you're right, you know, with what you have just said, that there is no power to delegate. We just need to recognize what is already in place.
Excellent. And further to that point, you noted in your work that we can look beyond the West and the United States for historical examples where federalism functions and where self-rule and polycentricity truly exists. And for Nigeria, you've highlighted the Yoruba people. If I did pronounce that correctly, you can, of course, correct me. Can you describe who these people are, a bit of their historical context, and what that sort of provides us as a proof point for self-rule and polycentric order?
Yeah. Thank you. I'm going to approach that carefully, and I will tell you the reason for that. Now, there is a mistake that people make, especially when they describe the Yoruba people as having the values of polycentric governance. That actually is not true in reality. But what is true is that we do have some settings in Yoruba land that is among the Yoruba of Nigeria that are polycentric in nature, which is what I want to, say here. Now, in my own studies, through the support I've got from Elinor Ostrom and Fisen Ostrom, I focus on three settings in Nigeria, but I will be talking only about two settings here today. And these are the 19th century cases of polycentric federalism, and those are called Abeokuta and Ibadan. So these two cities, they are located today in the southwestern part of Nigeria, no doubt about it. The two cities dominated by the Yoruba people of Nigeria. So, and what happened is that the two cities came into existence in the early part of the 19th century. So, and that actually occurred when the largest Yoruba kingdom collapsed. The other time I told you that we need to be careful that maybe the Yoruba people, wherever they live, they all have polycentric value. Not really, because the empire that collapsed before these two cities came into existence was a centralized system, and that empire was very repressive of the people that were operating under it. So when the empire collapsed in the early part of the 19th century, restless soldiers, went in different places. And some of them, develop these two, cities. So when these two cities emerged, there were certain important ingredients that they drool upon, especially to accomplish outstanding, things, and possibly just to let you see some things that they did accomplish in the city. For example, in Abeokuta, in particular, they detested centralization of power. And you could really see that. They came out of an oppressive system. They knew what that oppressive system was all about. It was a Yoruba system. It wasn't a foreign system. They knew what that was all about. So when they were trying to develop a new setting entirely, they decided that they will not follow, they will not embrace the oppressive institutions. Instead, they decided that they will be treating each other as equals in their setting. And they did quite a number of things, especially to do that. For example, they convenanted, by that I meant, they mutually agree that individuals will have freedoms to become a citizen. And just to explain that to you here, in Yoruba land in the 19th century, oinland, that is land ownership, happened to be the basis of citizenship. And typically speaking, before these two cities came into existence in the 19th century, what happened was that the founding lineage, better put, the family that established a Yoruba community owned all the land. And what that means is that immigrants or people who joined later, they could not be citizens. Only people from the family were treated as citizens. So this particular land, in these two cities, it was decided, which was a great accomplishment, very innovative, that land ownership as the non-transferable right of the founding lineage will no longer be recognized. What does that mean? They ensure that there was no lineage family land. There was no landless in the individual. And what was their goal? Without even contact with Europeans, without even contact with Hayek, whose work I use in this particular paper, these individuals, all that they were trying to do was to ensure that economic and political power will not be concentrated in the hands of few people. And they were able to pull this off without even, having anything about what was going on in Europe or in America. Mm-hmm. That was one. Number two, they ensure that political competition was open. What does that mean? That is, during this particular period, you must come from a particular family to hold a political office. And people who really did not belong to the family that were recognized to hold the political office, those individuals, they were not qualified. In these two cities, what they did was that they decided that personal performance, personal accomplishment in warfare, in trade, and in impartial judgment will be the basis of competing for political office. And interestingly, diverse individuals, even the immigrants who came later, they were free, to compete for political office in these two settings. Not only that, people could even compete for political office in in government units outside where they live, meaning that they could leave their own governing unit to go and compete for political office. And if you have seen what I've just talked about, you will now begin to see that citizenship was not confined to a particular group or within a particular setting in each of these cities, simply because people are free to compete, to fight for political office anywhere in each of these city. Something that is not present in Nigeria today, as I said earlier on, you could compete, if at all you are interested in competing for political office in whatever government that is out there, you can only do so in your own locality or your own state. That was not the case in each of these cities, people could go anywhere to compete for political office. Another major challenge that they confronted and they successfully overcame was relaxing, especially the tradition of group allegiance. As I said, in terms of Nigeria the other time, people, they still hold their strong allegiance to their ethnic groups today. In each of this particular city then, even though people, they came from different, even ethnic groups, people came from different places. We had, members of Fulani people, even in this city in the 19th century. But they ensure that people could enjoy freedom to associate with people of their choice. They could even form groups of their own choice without, basing the relationship on blood ties or some other thing that could hinder, freedom for diverse, people. And they did that successfully in each of, the city. So at the end of the day, one thing based on my observation, which of course I will, bring out from my own study, is that the peaceful coexistence that prevailed in each of the 19th century city that I'm talking about now provided a common market. A common market where numerous farmers, even traders, they were able to operate above the subsistence level. And this was also due to their innovative efforts, especially to promote economic and political integration among diverse individuals and groups. Thank you.
No, thank you very much for that tour, Oyabade. I think that was excellent. And as you were saying that, it really brings me back to something you said just a few minutes before that too, which is what you just described there as far as self-rule, participation, markets, and those types of freedoms. Like, things people would, a lot of people would generally say are just basic or should be basic sort of liberal values, goes beyond what you said before, which is just, the idea of this election in this federalism kind of thing. People focus so much on this idea of the process and the structure of federalism and especially elections. And I think, and unfortunately in many Western countries, that is the political cultural focus too, is, this democratic sort of order based on this election that happens every so many years. But I really love the way you describe that, frankly, because it really got into, in my view, how, yes, like here's a perfect example of how if we're being serious about values like Hayek, that Hayek brings forward, Ostrom, and so on and so forth, that this idea of self-rule, bottom-up spontaneous order isn't just about how we get to vote every few years, certainly.
You're right. And unfortunately, not just in Nigeria, in African countries, what is considered so-called democracy today is election. And it doesn't go beyond that. And that's a major tragedy that we are facing on the continent.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to many academics and intellectuals, especially in the West, who do think and study Hayek and Ostrom and thinkers like that, when it comes to spontaneous order, polycentric order, and so on and so forth, of course, I've noticed that many are not at all aware of non-Western examples. Of course, this can simply be explained by the fact that, that they, many of these academics, at least that I know, they live in the West, so that's what they're more familiar with. But I'm wondering if, at least I think this, it's my bias, but I want to hear your opinion as well. Do you think there's a bit of a, so to speak, top-down bias going on here, where some naturally only think the best examples of, the kind of values and discussions and findings that Hayek and Ostrom talk about can only come from the West? In other words, do you think there's a bit of a bias where some people think because they have relatively democratic structures, these are the only histories we need to look into, when in reality, you provided a great example of looking outside the West for these sort of things?
Yeah, that's a fabulous question. And I will look at it in a variety of ways. And otherwise, my response is going to be, looking at different, things. Now, let me go to the top-down, issue that you raised the other time. And this may not surprise you. One thing in Nigeria, and of course, part of our education, which has also distorted the mentality of people out there, is that the United States of America is the inventor of federalism. If you know what that means, it means a lot. That means if they are going to practice federalism at all, they have to copy everything from the United States and superimpose whatever they are copying on each of these countries. That's one of the tragedy. And interestingly, scholars that are teaching federalism, I'm not talking about every scholar in Nigeria or in Africa, the emphasis is still on this idea that the United States is the inventor of federalism. That is where federalism is. There is no other federalism, no other cases of federalism elsewhere. And that's a major crisis. And let me tell you something that I'm a victim of too. I learned a lot of economics while I was in Nigeria. And I find this quite emotional. And I say emotional in the sense that when I was exposed to economics, in particular when you talk about the invisible hand and stuff, I was exposed to just the mathematical part of it. I love it. I love doing all those, econometrics kind of equation and all kind of stuff. But in our own kind of education, unlike what I find when I came to the Ostrom workshop and then, talking to my colleagues, especially, I'm not sure if you are well of this colleague of mine, Brandon Christian, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the last name correctly, who got me, he exposed me to Hayek in particular. Now, the philosophical foundation of the work of Adam Smith and Hayek, those were literally taken out of the education they are giving us in economics. So the philosophical aspect of the invisible hand, we did not get to know anything about that. If you were to tell me about spontaneous order, I'll be talking about confusion and disorganization. I didn't know what that means. And this also speaks to why, for example, the works of Adam Smith in particular, not really understood, in its entirety. I'm not talking about people not understanding part of it, but in its entirety, the philosophical part of it, the quantitative part of it. So not completely presented. Whether that was deliberate or not, I don't know. I don't know how many African scholars even have access to Hayek in terms of, his idea of spontaneous order. And I will be talking more about his individualism and functionalism methodology. So, those areas too, not really, we are not exposed to that. And that's a big challenge. That's a big challenge in terms of engaging in scholarship about spontaneous order regarding the cases of spontaneous order in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. No, thank you. That makes a lot of sense. And Oyebade, I mean, our time has flown here. We're actually almost at the point where we have to wrap up the episode. But before I bring us to the formal wrap up, let me ask you, is there anything I did not ask you about this topic and this great educational tour you provided in Nigeria and all the other things we talked about? Is there anything I didn't ask you that you would still like to share with our listeners or actually sort of provide information on, or just any of your other thoughts that I didn't ask you? Because again, I'm not very familiar with this topic, so sometimes I have a hard time figuring out exactly where to guide the conversation. So I hope I've done okay so far, but I did want to ask you if there's anything I didn't ask you that you would like to talk about.
Well, it seems that we've been able to cover important issues as far as federalism in Nigeria in particular is concerned. So, and I would say that you've done a great job.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's probably the best answer for that question I could have heard. So I'll take that and run with it, Oyebade, to our formal wrap-up. Thank you so much. And let me say, we have talked about a lot. Let's try and bring the conversation full circle and put a finer point on an exploration of the question. In each episode, I want to make sure the guest ultimately has the last word. So let me ask you, what do you ultimately hope are the main takeaways for someone listening to you here on federalism, Nigeria, and all the other topics we discussed. In other words, if you wanted someone listening to you here to take away only one, two, or a few things, what do you want them to take away?
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Number one, whether we are talking about a global federation or we're talking about a smaller federation, what is key is that the constitution of that kind of federal system must focus especially on individual liberty. And of course, that may not be accomplished if governance is not by agreement. And when I say governance by agreement, not by agreement among elites, not by agreement among experts, agreement among the people who sit with their own problem. That is, agreement among the people who are problem owners, so that as they think about the challenges they face, those people will also operate as the solution owner. And that is, you know, very important. And in addition to that, when we're talking about governing arrangement, different constituent units will need to have irrevocable power. It doesn't matter the size. It doesn't matter the number of functions. So those governing units, they will need to have irrevocable power that cannot be taken away from them without the consent of the people who operate within those jurisdictional unit. And I think this is critical when we are talking about polycentric governance, or we're talking about federalism in any part of the world. And again, too, the ideal of labeling, we need to begin to distance ourselves from that, simply because the concept that we use as victims of definitional pluralism. So when we are talking about polycentricity or polycentric governance, our focus here is not about decentralization at all. Even though, for example, polycentric governance has some place for centralization, not in terms of controlling people, but in terms of having a central unit. So there's a place for that. And at the same time, polycentric governance is not necessarily decentralization. And this is a bigger, issue here. So there's need for us to really understand, for example, all the concepts in context. And this is something I want people to think carefully about.
And I think that's an excellent place to leave it. So Oyabade Oyarande, thank you very much for joining me on The Curious Task today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, and have a wonderful day.
The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. This episode was produced by Alex Aragona, Sabine Elchidiak, and Eric Seguin. Our executive producer is Matt Bufton. The music you hear on the podcast is by Lindy Voppenfjord. You should check out his other stuff online. The Curious Task exists today because of donations of time and money from those creating it and listeners like yourself. Check us out on Patreon and find out how you can support us and get access to exclusive offers. I'm Alex Aragona, and thank you very much for joining us on The Curious Task. Bye.